following was a recording of Anand Menon presenting the future of the European Union on October 13, 2017.
Just a few weeks following the momentous Brexit referendum in June 2016, the former Foreign Minister of the United Kingdom, David Miliband, addressed an audience in the United States. Mr. Miliband was asked what he thought the implications might be of this momentous vote. He responded, quote, "It's a stake in the heart of the European Union," unquote. Will things really turn out that way? Well, Professor Anand Menon can provide us considerable insights into actually the implications of that vote and where he thinks it's headed for both the European Union and Great Britain. Anand Menon is professor of European politics and political and foreign affairs at King's College London. In 2015, he was appointed director of the Economic and Social Research Council's initiative on the UK in a changing Europe. That was before anybody thought about this Brexit vote, and turned out to be quite prescient. I would parenthetically add that the website for that organization has a plethora of information on the background of Brexit and on current developments that are ongoing in terms of that process. He's also an associate fellow at Chatham House, which is widely regarded as one of the foremost policy institutes in Europe, if not not the world, and a specialist advisor to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons. Previous academic engagements include 11 years as professor of West European politics at the University of Birmingham, 10 years as a university lecturer in politics at Oxford University, and visiting positions at New York University, Columbia University, and the Free University of Brussels. He was awarded a PhD in international relations from Oxford University. Professor Menon, we welcome you, and I hope all of us will join in a warm welcome to Hilton Head.
Let me just start by saying thank you to Lee and to Ed for inviting me and for being such gracious hosts. Thank you all for coming. I must confess, if I was one of you, having seen the weather outside and the beach, I wouldn't be here, so hats off to you for that. I should also thank Ed for freeing me from the shackles of Brexit by asking me not to talk about Brexit. As he said, we've been doing this for about 3 years now, to the point where if we go out on a Friday or Saturday night, my wife will invariably say, "Do not bore on about bloody Brexit all evening, okay?" So this feels like a liberation in the sense that I get to talk about the European Union. That being said, I feel like I've been thrown what I think Americans call a curveball by being asked to talk about the future. Now, we all know, having watched politics for the last couple of years, that only a fool would talk about the future. So I'm being set up to be a fool, and I fully expect that everything I say will be proved to have been wrong by the end of lunch, probably, if not by the end of the year. So what I'm going to do several things. I'm going to start with the basics. I'm going to talk briefly about what the EU is and why it exists, because I think it's worth getting that background before we start talking about the contemporary challenges that face it. And I think there are three big challenges facing the European Union. There's the challenge of monetary union and the euro. There's the challenge of migration. And there's the challenge of dealing with international relations, with insecurity on the borders, with wider problems of the international system. So I'm going to consider all those challenges, what they are, how they appear, what the dangers they present are, and then I'm going to look briefly at some of the solutions that have been suggested to those challenges. We've seen in last month, in September, there were two major speeches made. President Macron of France made a big and enormously long, it has to be said, I think he went on for about 2 hours, speech at the Sorbonne about the future of the European Union. A couple of weeks before that, President Juncker, the President of the European Commission, had made a State of the Union address, thinly modelled on the one that happens here, though fewer people watch it or pay any attention to it, it has to be said, in which he too spelled out some ideas. And I'm going to briefly consider what they said, whether they have provided potential solutions for the European Union's current problems. I'm going to touch briefly on Brexit because I feel I should, and I'll probably start twitching if I don't, before rounding up with some general thoughts about populism in Europe and what it means, and then concluding, and hopefully leaving a lot of time for questions at the end. So to start with, what is the European Union? I think the first thing that should be said, and it's worth saying over and over again, is the European Union is a completely unique political entity. And this matters because whenever we judge politics, we tend to, if only implicitly in our heads, judge it comparatively. So we'll say, look, the European Union's doing this, but America's doing that. And there's a big difference. It's almost invariably an unfair comparison because the European Union is not a state like the United States, but nor is it a traditional international organization like the United Nations. It is a hybrid. It's messy. It's confusing because of that. But let me just try and talk to you briefly about some of the things that make the European Union unique. It produces law that takes precedence over the law of its member states. This is what's called supremacy. It's a big deal, and if you think about it, it is unique, I think, probably in the history of international relations. You have an international organization that can pass law. It can pass law and outvote member states in passing law, and if they have a contradictory provision in national law, they have to scrap it. The law of the European Union takes precedence over pre-existing national law. Okay? Not only that, but EU law applies directly to citizens. Those of you with any experience of international law will know that international law binds states. It binds the signatories of treaties, which are states and their governments. EU law is a lot more like domestic law because it is binding on the individual. Individuals can go to court under matters of EU law, which again makes it feel a bit like a nation state, even though it isn't, because that sort of law is unique in the history of international relations again. The European Union contains the world's only democratically elected transnational parliament. There are plenty of things wrong with the European Parliament, and I'm not amongst its defenders, but it is transnational and it is directly elected democratically by the people of the member states, and it is the only organization of its kind in the world. And of course, there is the scope of the European Union. Its activities cover everything from setting prices for rapeseed oil to defense and macroeconomic policy. There is no international organization in the world that does so much over so many things. And one of the great achievements of the European Union has been, if you want to think about it this way, it's domesticated international relations. Member states interact together now in a way that looks and feels like domestic politics on issues over which they would have had diplomatic relations before the European Union was created. So there's a sort of domestic politics feel to what goes on the continent of Europe, even though you're talking about 27 sovereign states and not one single political entity. Enlargement has spread stability throughout the continent. One of the great achievements of the European Union is to be part of a process that allowed the countries of Central and Eastern Europe to emerge from communism, to not fight wars over their disputed borders, and to transition relatively peacefully. I say relatively because actually they're a work in progress and there are a lot of things happening now to be concerned about, but to transition relatively peacefully and stably to being market economies with more or less democratic political systems. So my starting point is, before I go on to spend the next 40 minutes picking holes in it, that the European Union is unique. It is a remarkable achievement. It is the first thing ever to look like this in international politics, and given the history of Europe for the 100 years before its creation, it is nothing short of a miracle that it exists and that it has survived for as long as it has. That might be the last positive thing I say, so buckle up. So, why do we have the European Union? I think it's worth thinking about this before we think about why it's not working at the moment. You think back. The Swiss-French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau used an analogy to try and explain why cooperation is so difficult in international relations. And the analogy he used was a stag hunt. And he said, imagine four men with spears. It was obviously men back when he was writing. He didn't talk about women very much in his books. Four men go out with spears to hunt a deer, okay? The spears aren't very good, the deer is quite big, so it would take four of them to bring a deer down. Off they go into the woods, hunting the deer. One of the hunters sees a rabbit, kills it, takes it home because that's enough to feed his family, leaving the other three unable to get the deer. And he said, this is an analogy for international politics. States may need to cooperate, states may benefit from cooperating, but someone is going to screw the others. Someone is going to cheat, someone is going to steal, and basically, in the state of nature that is international relations, there is nothing you can do about it, so why not just not bother cooperating in the first place, because you're bound to be disappointed, okay? Well, there's one way you can get over this, and that is to go back to the hunt analogy if you create what I'm going to call, for the sake of argument, a hunt czar, okay? You appoint a village elder, and you say to the village elder, you are in charge of making sure everyone respects the rules of the hunt, okay? And you have the power to confiscate rabbits. If you think about this, immediately the rules of the game change. It is no longer in your interest to hunt to get a rabbit, because not only do you let the side down, but your family don't get the rabbit either. Okay? And essentially, that is what the European Union is. It is a form, it is a set of institutions designed to ensure that member states play by rules that they have jointly agreed. It allows them to do more collectively than they could do independently. And the need for this is simply, if you look at a map of Europe, what you see is a map of a load of extremely small states that are incapable of doing much at all by themselves. Even the big European states are small. Even Germany's small, thinking globally. Luxembourg, you'd need a microscope to see it on the map. So you have enormous interdependence between very, very small states, which means that cooperation is necessary because everyone depends on doing things together, whether it's trade, whether it's foreign policy, you name it. And the European Union is a way of creating a system to make sure no one cheats. Okay? The problem, and this is what I call the paradox of integration in Europe, is whilst there is a good functional explanation for the European Union, national politics isn't always rational. Countries, nationalism, feelings of identity aren't rational, they aren't based on economic performance, they're based on feelings of identity, of belonging, that have nothing to do with economic provision. There is no rationale for the state of Luxembourg, at all, okay? There is no rational reason you should give me why Luxembourg should exist. It's small, it's useless, it can't do anything for itself. But the people of Luxembourg would disagree with me. I hope there's no one here from Luxembourg, and so we would talk afterwards. And they would say, Luxembourg exists because I feel like a Luxembourger, and I want Luxembourg to control its own destiny. And that political sense, the need for control, the need for authority, pulls against the functional rationale for European integration. And that tension, I'm going to suggest to you now, lies at the heart of the problems that the European Union has. Because, and remember this as my final introductory remark, because of this tension, because of the integration paradox, because of the tension between the need for cooperation and the desire for control, the European Union is an incredibly weak political system. Member states cooperate, but only as far as they need to. They try and retain as much control as possible. There is a very high threshold for passing laws. There's a unanimity threshold for amending the treaties. There is no enforcement capacity. Think about this for a minute. Think back to Brown versus Board of Education. Okay, the Supreme Court makes a ruling. Some of the southern states say, yeah, whatever. What happens? You send in the National Guard. There is no European National Guard. You depend on the goodwill of the member states to accept the law. Sadly, we have no mechanism for invading France if it decides to disobey the law. Okay? One day. But what that means is, this is a system that works on the basis of goodwill. You can't compel people to listen to what the European Union says, which makes it inherently fragile, because it's a consensus-based system that's made up of sovereign states that do not cede control lightly. So let's turn to the first of the issues that I raised, the Eurozone. Now, everything looks a lot better than it used to. The IMF, we've had that Eurozone crisis that was in the news for 7 or 8 years. Now, all of a sudden, the IMF is raising growth forecasts. Business confidence is the highest it's been for a decade. Unemployment is the lowest it's been since 2008. Everything seems to be looking up for the Eurozone. The indicators are good. But bear in mind several things. One, some of the specific problems that haunted the Eurozone and were apparent in the sovereign debt crisis remain. The weakness of the banking system in a number of member states. Italy is a particular culprit here. Monte del Paschi and other two banks were bailed out in June. They've started to sell off their bad debts, but think about it. They've sold off 18 billion euros worth of bad debts out of a total holding of 300 billion euros. Which is to say, a lot of that bad debt remains. The balance books are inherently fragile. It wouldn't take much of a crisis to leave these banks needing a full-on bailout. If economic growth continues, it's fine, but the structural problems remain. Secondly, in October, in case you've been missing the Greek story, the review by creditors of the Greek bailout begins again. The Greek government has to implement 95 measures, some of them very, very painful, in order to satisfy its creditors. If this process drags on, if it looks problematic, it will lead to jitters, it will lead to the spreads increasing again as they did before the first bailout. The Greek stock market performed worse in September than it has done since 2016. So again, it's an inherently fragile situation. Whilst the underlying economic figures are good, in other words, the structural problems of the Eurozone have not been addressed. And talking of structural problems, just think about some of the headline negative figures. Debt to GDP ratio in Italy is 133% still, at a time when the economy is starting to grow. Youth unemployment in Italy is 35.5%. It's 24% in France. It's over 50% in Greece. So when we talk about a recovering economy, we should bear in mind that we're talking about a very low bar and that actually real problems exist. 15% of the Greek population still lives in extreme poverty. And that figure before the Eurozone crisis was 2%. So when people talk to you about recovery, bear in mind they mean it in a very specific sense. There are still real problems here. Now, the picture is uncertain at best, and one of the reasons for that is the thing I started off with, that paradox of integration, the tension between cooperation and control. There is no serious EU-level fiscal mechanism to allow the centre to intervene if one of the parts is hit by an asymmetric shock. Why not? Because the Germans don't want to give over control of their budget. Why would you? We're not giving our control of our budget to the bloody Greeks. They'll spend it on holidays and swimming pools. That's a waste of time. Okay? But that we feeling, where however grudgingly, in this country, if you get a Hurricane Katrina, the states contribute to a bailout of the state. And there's moaning and there's whinging. But there's no refusal and there's no mechanism to veto. In the EU, there is refusal and a mechanism to veto, which means that the Eurozone remains profoundly fragile. We can't address fiscal shocks in one part with monetary shocks with fiscal means, and because we're talking about separate countries, levels of mobility between EU member states are very, very low. You live in Louisiana and you have a hurricane, you might want to shift to Georgia or somewhere. In the EU, it is very, very hard to move. It tends to be only the educated elite that move. You've got problems of culture, problems of language, all sorts of issues that stop you moving. So we'll see in our universities in the UK a massive rise in the number of Spaniards, Italians, Greeks who come to study in England because there is very little in the way of a future here. But these are the kids of the elite, a very small part of the population. There are no stabilization mechanisms. And that, I think, is all down to the fundamental fact that Europe is a regional economy with 27 sets of national politics inside it. And that tension means it's very, very hard to solve the Eurozone problem. And the Eurozone problem is made worse and has been made worse over the last couple of years by the migration crisis, which you've probably all seen on the news. Thousands upon thousands of migrants on these heartbreakingly small ships crossing the Mediterranean, being ferried by people smugglers to get away from Africa and into Europe. Again, the short-term news is good. In August, there were under 40,000 arrivals in Italy from North Africa, which sounds a lot, but it is a fifth of the number that arrived in August last year. So the numbers are slowing down, though 40,000 is still a lot. But bear in mind, over the last 3 years, Italy has had to take in 500,000 migrants from North Africa. And this is an Italian economy that is stretched already. They're having to pay for these people. They're having to set up camps for these people. They're having to, anyone who's come into contact with the Italian administration knows this is a joke, they're having to administer these camps. Heaven help us. Now, what the EU has done is said, we're going to implement a relocation scheme and offer cash. But as ever, the EU response has been pitiful. It has offered 900 million euros to the southern states, compared to an estimated bill they face of 4 billion euros for caring for these refugees. It has said we're having a refugee relocation target, but has met only 5% of that target to date. Why? Because some states have said, actually, you know what? We're Christian, we're white, we don't want these foreigners. The countries of Central and Eastern Europe have simply said no. Hungary has taken exactly none of the 1,249 refugees the European Commission says it is liable for. And again, there is no way of enforcing this. There is a weakness at the centre. The European Union's problems come from excessive weakness as much as from overriding strength. Hungary can simply turn round to Brussels and say, do you want to try making us? Because you can't. We're not doing it. And of course, the Hungarian government has massive domestic support for saying this. Added to this, the migration crisis has dragged the European Union into partnerships with a load of unsavory regimes. The reason why the figures for migration are going down, amongst other things, is that the Europeans have decided to pay significant amounts of money to one of the Libyan governments, because of course there are several, to basically set up camps in the Sahara to dump these people so they don't reach Europe and they don't leave our TV screens. This is sick. It's unhumanitarian. It is a betrayal of liberal values. And it is also, I would imagine, unsustainable. One of the biggest push factors for migrants moving from Libya to Europe now is the inhumane conditions in the camps that the EU has set up to hold them. This can't go on forever. There's going to be another population boom in sub-Saharan Africa. They reckon another 1 billion people over the next 20 to 25 years. Unless the continent is stabilized, where are they going to come? They're going to come north, they're going to come to Europe, and the Sahara just ain't big enough to stick them in camps. So long term, Europe needs to do some serious thinking and needs to find a way to act collectively despite the objections of individual national governments. The third issue was the EU's world role. And here, if you think back to the speeches that Macron and Juncker made, foreign policy was a key theme. And one of the reasons foreign policy is a key theme when people are talking about the future of Europe now is thanks to you kind people. Your president has made us feel slightly less secure than we once did, for a whole host of reasons. But one of them is, even though even prior to the election of Donald Trump, the Article 5 guarantee of NATO was looking a little bit shaky if you happen to live in one of the Baltic states. Now, it looks completely and utterly unreliable. So all of a sudden, what you'll see if you go to Scandinavia and you talk to the Finns or you talk to the Swedes is they'll say, we have to do more as Europeans because ultimately, who the hell knows what the White House will decide to do? And we cannot pin our future security solely on an American security guarantee. Okay? But again, exactly the same tension comes to light, that tension between national control and collective action. Everything the European Union does when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to defence policy, is governed by a unanimity law, which means that Luxembourg, I know I'm picking on you today, has the ability to veto a decision about military deployments, if it so chose. Okay, it's the same as, you know, one of the 50. I mean, the European Union, if you want to think about it in parallel, imagine a meeting of the governors of US states that had to approve every single decision and each governor had a veto. Nothing at all would get done. That is the system that we have inside Europe at the moment. Everyone has a veto. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that the EU is totally ineffective. If you think about the deal signed with Iran that you kind people are about to tear up today, it was a very good deal. It took a lot of patient negotiating, and the European Union played a key role in sorting that deal out. But I would argue that the Iran deal was largely the exception and not the rule. If you think back to the sanctions imposed on Russia after the invasion of Crimea, the stage three sanctions were ultimately only possible in Europe because of the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner and the death of all those Dutch citizens. I would bet, and it's a safe bet because you can't prove me wrong because it's a counterfactual, had that not happened, the European Union would not have found unanimity to impose greater sanctions on Russia. Why? Because we do a lot of trade with Russia. German business was apoplectic about the idea of more sanctions on Russia. But the politics and the sort of, you know, the mood music following that Malaysian airliner shooting down meant that the political pressure became irresistible. If you think about the EU as a military actor, we have this thing called the Common Security and Defence Policy. And the European Union, in principle, has the ability to deploy troops or deploy military forces, and it has done so. We've deployed token forces to African states every now and again, though none of those missions have been worth talking about. We've deployed peacekeepers to the Balkans with some effect, though generally the European Union likes to go in after NATO has done the hard work and just tidy up what's left. And we've got deployed a naval force off the coast of East Africa, which is an unmitigated triumph. I mean, I don't know if you've watched Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks film about piracy off the east coast of Africa. One of the great triumphs of EU foreign policy is we have reduced the scale of piracy by 90% over the last 4 years through a variety of means, in a way that the European Union, unlike any other international organization, can deploy a number of different tools. We've had a naval force out there in the sea to try and hunt the pirates down. At the same time, the European Union is giving money to the government in Somalia. The European Union is funding fishermen. Many of the fishermen, this is the circularity of international politics. Many of the reasons for piracy off the coast of Somalia go back to Europe because Spanish fishermen decided they'd fish the waters off Somalia, fish them dry. The Somali fishermen didn't have an income or a livelihood anymore and so turned to piracy and started kidnapping European boats. So, you know, everything is interconnected, but one of the things the European Union is doing is repopulating those waters with fish, funding fishing villages. There's a very much a sort of whole-scale approach, a holistic approach, which has been working. But again, it's the exception rather than the rule. And I think in military terms, this is for two reasons. One, because European states have very, very different approaches to using force in international politics. Britain and France have always seen using force as something that's quite cool, makes you look quite tough. It's a good thing to do every now and again. Public opinion in general is quite supportive, sometimes, as we've seen in the last decade and a half, wrongly so. If you're Germany, for obvious historical reasons, using force is generally illegitimate and to be avoided at all costs. Bringing those together in a consensus where everyone has a veto is far from easy. So the EU is hamstrung by the cultural differences between its member states, between, if you like, the carnivores like Britain and France and the herbivores like the Germans. Okay? But secondly, European Union is hamstrung when it comes to defense because we don't have the military hardware necessary for modern military interventions. Not because we don't spend enough, we spend an awful lot of money on defence in Europe, but because we spend it in an inefficient and fragmented way. Luxembourg has its own armed forces. Okay? Both of them. But what this means is if you're splitting up your spending between 28 armies with 28 military colleges, 28 logistics supply routes, 15 or 16 different missile programs at any given time, you do not have to have a PhD in economics to realize that this is economically inefficient in the extreme, okay? And that actually you could do far more with the same money if you rationalized, if you cut out excess capacity, if you said rather than having 27 staff colleges, let's have one staff college. The Nordics tried this a few years ago. They had meeting after meeting to say, you know, we've got these military training colleges, we all do pretty much the same thing, why don't we combine them? Great idea. They had 2 years working groups, agreed on a syllabus and all this. It was absolutely fantastic till they got to the meeting where they had to decide where the new campus would be. Yeah, you guessed. Everyone just vetoed it. They said, well, actually, I was kind of thinking it would be in Sweden. Oh, really? And that is the problem. Rationalization makes sense until you think politically. And politics isn't rational. Politics is about control. It is very, very hard to overcome these things. And bear in mind There's a historical explanation for this as well. I said at the start the European Union is weak. Yes, it's weak, but it's not weak through bad luck. It is weak through design. And this haunts its actions when it comes to international politics. Think about the context in which the first institutions of European integration were created. It was the context of the end of the Second World War. What was everyone thinking at the end of the Second World War? We must prevent big powers from dominating small powers ever again. So we'll create a complex, technocratic, multi-layered system, which is bafflingly difficult to understand, and which it is impossible for any single country to dominate. And that means the European Union was created to diffuse power, deliberately, because of the experience of the Second World War, which makes it almost uniquely ill-adapted as a system for projecting power, which is what we're asking it to do today. You want the EU to do military missions? Well, you've got the wrong institution, because it was specifically designed to tame power. Okay? If you told the founders of European integration that one of the biggest single problems that Europe faces today is the problem of trying to get Germany to deploy more soldiers into war zones, they'd have opened the champagne. They'd have said, mission accomplished. That's precisely what European integration was for. Thank you very much. The thing is, the world has changed, and our requirements of the European Union have changed, but the system, the structures, the institutions remain roughly the same. So you have a set of institutions that were set up for one purpose, now being asked to perform what is essentially a completely contradictory role. You just compare it with the United States. I mean, everyone says initially when the Constitution was signed, when you had the Constitutional Convention, they created a weak, decentralized federal system. No, you didn't. If you compare it to the European Union, you created a massively centralized system. The president can raise taxes. The president is the commander-in-chief. The right to deploy force from the start resided in Washington, and the president was able to override the individual states. And if you think about the history of your country, military force has been central to the emergence of the United States of America. It was only after the Civil War that Americans started to refer to the United States in the singular. Beforehand, it had always been referred to in the plural. And subsequently, wars like, particularly the big wars of the 20th century, have been the reason why the power of the center has expanded. You ended up with this massive military after the Second World War and the infrastructure necessary to run it. War is fundamental and central to state building and has been for the last 200 to 300 years, but the European Union lacks the power to do it. So not only is it ineffective as an international actor, but that ineffectiveness impinges on its ability to build a sense of nationhood and the sort of centralized state that some people, not myself I have to say, want the European Union to grow into. So let's turn to the solutions. The two speeches, Emmanuel Macron and Jean-Claude Juncker. Macron has a plan. And his plan, first and foremost, is a plan for the Eurozone. And the plan goes something like this. I am going to pass domestic reforms. The Germans are going to be really impressed that I've passed domestic reforms, and in return for those domestic reforms, they're going to give me concessions on the Eurozone. And on the Eurozone, what I'm after is some kind of risk sharing, some kind of budget for the Eurozone countries by themselves, and some kind of Eurozone finance minister to take the decisive action that the Eurozone needs. Okay? The problem with this plan, this Franco-German plan, is that the Germans don't agree with it. The Germans will just about stomach the creation of a finance minister. If I were deeply cynical, I would say, yeah, why wouldn't they? Because he won't be able to tell anyone what to do. He'll just have an office in Brussels and that's that. Because again, I don't think the French are going to create a European Union finance minister who can overrule the Minister of Finances in Paris. That's not how it works. Okay? But the Germans are allergic to risk sharing. It's the Greeks with the swimming pools again. And they're allergic to the idea of the European Union having its own independent budget, because that sounds like another budget bankrolled by the German taxpayer. So ultimately, it's a very fragile plan that President Macron has had. And more than that, I think his speech, I mean, seriously, you can read it if you want, but it's about 30 pages. opened up a whole load of fault lines within the European Union that are going to make solving its problems harder rather than easier. The first fault line was the North-South fault line. Macron recently went to Greece, and I don't know if you saw the speech, but he spoke in surprisingly critical terms about the role of the IMF in the Greek bailout. Expressed solidarity with the Greeks for their problems and the fact they've been mistreated by the IMF. Has expressed solidarity with the Italians about the refugee crisis. But on refugees, the French have still not met their quota that the EU has set for the number of immigrants that France should take in. So the southern states look at France and they say, this is great, your rhetoric is fantastic, French is a beautiful language after all, but you've done nothing. And that suspicion is the first fault line in the European Union now when it comes to solutions for the future. The second fault line, and it's a fault line that's exacerbated by Brexit, that's 32 minutes, and that's the first time I've said Brexit. That's some kind of record. I'm going to tell my wife when I get home. The other division that has been exacerbated by Brexit is the division between states who are in the euro and states who are out of the euro. Britain was the leading player of the states outside the euro. We battled hard for the rights of non-euro states. We shouldn't be discriminated against by euro states. Now, the eurozone economies account for 85% of the EU economy once Britain has left. The pressure on the non-eurozone states to join the euro is simply going to ramp up. In his State of the Union address, President Juncker said, "We aspire to a situation in which every single EU member state is a member of the euro." And so this is a second fault line. You talk about a budget for the eurozone. You talk about a finance minister for the eurozone. Are you going to get the support of states who don't have the euro for a new system of governance that they're excluded from? No. It's another of the fault lines within the European Union. The third fault line is between states that are suspicious of centralization. And here, particularly the states of Central and Eastern Europe come to mind. Whenever anyone talks about core Europe, as President Macron did, the smaller countries, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, hear Europe without us. They are trying to create an inner circle for them and the Germans to do their own thing and to leave us to one side because they consider us an irritation. So the centralizers versus the non-centralizers. And finally, on top of this, and perhaps most importantly, there is a growing values divide within the European Union. You are, I imagine, vaguely familiar with the things that are going on in Hungary and Poland at the moment, as governments basically act enormously illiberal. They make attacks on the press. In Poland, the government is launching attacks on the independent judiciary. Very, very worrying illiberal tendencies. You have illiberal governments in these countries that dislike President Macron immensely, because he is the poster boy of globalization and liberalization, two things that they hate. And crucially, this division, unlike some of the others, is not likely to get better simply in the event of the economic cycle lifting Europe up because of economic growth. Because this is a values divide, not an economic ideology divide. This is a difference between social liberals and social conservatives. It's the division that lay behind, to an extent, the election of President Trump. It's the division that, to a significant extent, lay behind the Brexit vote. Oops, twice. But it's one that is deep-rooted and very, very hard to overcome. So for all these reasons, I do not hold out any great hope that Macron and Juncker have the keys to success in their pocket. Their words were great, but I do not see how they can deliver. And actually, one simple reason why I do not see how they deliver is any change to the EU structure, a eurozone finance minister, a eurozone budget, requires a treaty change. Any treaty change has to be passed by unanimous agreement of all the member states, which is going to be hard, if not impossible, to get. Not least because, in at least three member states, they are constitutionally committed to having referendums on any treaty change. And here, let me assure you, Britain is not the only country where a population would vote against something associated with the European Union. Britain is just the only country where we're silly enough to let them vote on membership rather than on a treaty, which was the big difference. All right, this is my 30 seconds on Brexit. but we can do more in the questions and answers if you want. I'm not going to talk about what Brexit means for the UK. We can discuss that later. But let me say several things about Brexit and the EU. Firstly, one of the problems that Britain faces is, given the crises I've just outlined that the European Union faces, Brexit isn't on the list of top priorities for the other EU member states, which means that they haven't got their attention on it. Their number one priority isn't to strike a deal with us. They're thinking about migration or the Eurozone or whatever else. Bear in mind, it's simply not the case, as some people in continental Europe seem to claim, that us leaving opens the door for them solving their problems. You'll hear rhetoric from continental Europe: the Brits have gone, we can forge ahead. Well, good luck with that, because the Brits weren't in the Euro. The Brits weren't in the Schengen borderless zone. And yet you had failed to resolve the Eurozone crisis and the refugee crisis whilst we were members. Us leaving makes no difference. The structural problems of European integration remain the same with or without us. Britain was not the country blocking solutions to the big challenges that the EU faces. However, the one thing, I don't think Britain leaving is going to cause a massive jolt to the European Union. I think David Miliband was wrong on that. But I would say something is that if by some miracle our government changed its mind and we decided to stay in the European Union now, that would be the worst of all possible worlds for the European Union. Because Britain's politics are poisonous. 50% of the British people don't like the European Union. In the referendum campaign, we were told we give far too much money to the European Union. If we stayed in now, we would just be seething, ill-tempered, unhelpful, and would veto everything. So I think those Europeans who still think, wouldn't it be nice if they stayed, should be careful what they wish for. And finally, the other big question about Brexit, I suppose, is what is the risk of emulation? Will someone else try it? My answer is no. My answer is no for at least three reasons. One, because a lot of member states of the European Union are small countries. Small countries do not dispose of security blankets lightly. Being in the European Union reassures the Baltic states. It reassures the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. Not that we're going to protect them against Russia, but they're part of a bigger whole. So being a small country doesn't feel quite as lonely as it might. Secondly, many of the member states, most of the member states, are members of the Euro. If you think Brexit is complicated, imagine leaving the European Union and leaving the single currency. You would have a massively devaluing national currency at the same time you were doing it all. It would be a car crash. This isn't a positive reason for staying. It's a positive reason for not going, which is a different thing. This isn't because people love the European Union. This is because people are becoming aware of the fact that leaving it would be a nightmare. So people just sit and seethe and complain rather than thinking about leaving. And the third, more positive reason why I don't think there'll be emulation is the fact that Europe is part of the politics of Central and Eastern Europe of the other European states in a way it never was in the UK. If you watch a French president make a speech, he does so in front of the EU flag. That would be unthinkable in Britain. The European Union is part of the political DNA in the other member states in a way it simply wasn't and isn't in my country. However, none of this is to say they're free of the kinds of problems that Britain has. Because the kind of populism that I think the Brexit vote represented is present in many other member states too. I'm going to do a Theresa May in a moment if I don't have a drink and just start coughing for about an hour. One of the things that's happened this year is a lot of people have celebrated the fact that the populists didn't win elections in France, the populists didn't win elections in the Netherlands. Pause for a moment. We're celebrating because Nazis didn't win an election in France. My God, what has the world come to that is something to celebrate? That used to be something we took for granted. But anyway, leave that to one side. We've celebrated too soon. If you think about the situation in the Netherlands, you have a four-party government, which will be incapable of agreeing on anything because the four parties hate each other's guts. So we have to wait and see whether the Netherlands is governable for the next 3 years. One of the parties in that four-party coalition is the Christian Union, which 5 years ago was campaigning to break up the Eurozone. So that's not a triumph for pro-EU feeling. 63 out of the 150 MPs in the Dutch parliament are openly hostile to the European Union. The governing OVP in Austria which faces a battle with the Freedom Party in the elections this weekend, and the Freedom Party might yet win. But actually, it doesn't really matter whether the Freedom Party wins or not, to some extent, because the OVP has managed to fight off the challenge from the right by adopting the language and policies of the far right anyway. So in a sense, you have a government of the centre that is acting like a government of the far right, and part of that is a tone of hostility towards the European Union. In France, yes, Macron won. Let's not go over the top about Macron. He won because the two big parties collapsed in on themselves. Had that not happened, he would have lost. But in the first round of the election system, of the electoral process in France, they have two rounds, 40% of the vote went to parties critical of the political establishment and of the European Union, far left and far right. And if he doesn't succeed in reforming the economy as he's promised, if he doesn't go beyond fine speeches in Versailles and in the Sorbonne to actually address the chronic problems of unemployment and deprivation that the French feel that led to them to vote for the far right, the next French election might be an ugly affair. I'm not saying she'll win. I don't think she will win, because let's face it, the French electoral system is rigged precisely to ensure that people like her can't win. But if she's getting 20, 25, 28, 30% in the first round, it is the sign of a very sick political system. And the problem here, going back to Macron's Europe speech, is it's all very well standing up and making a speech in which you talk about a finance minister for the EU. You talk about creating more universities, European universities, to educate the middle class about the EU. But there was nothing in there about the real social and economic problems that bedevil the people outside the ruling class in France. And that is where the political problem lies. And I just hope, I hope with all my heart, that President Macron doesn't turn into one of those presidents who talks a fine game to the people who support him anyway, but continues to leave to one side those people that have been protesting against the French system by voting Marine Le Pen for 10 or 15 years now. Because that will just turn sour eventually. Let me conclude with a few brief remarks. As I said, the weird thing about the European Union is it's this odd halfway house between a full federation, a normal state, and a traditional international organization. You can't box it because it has elements of both, which makes it very hard to know what you should expect from it. And this paradox of integration I talked about looms large in everything the EU tries to do at the moment. That tension, that visceral tension between the need to cooperate and the longing for control. People will cooperate, but they'll only give as much power as they can get away with giving, because actually domestic politicians quite like keeping power for themselves. And you see that in the Eurozone crisis. You see that over migration. You see it in foreign policy. And the fact of the matter is, there is no easy way out of this. I don't think reform or forging forward towards a federal Europe is possible, as I said. But I don't think unpicking what they've already created is possible either. You can't unpick the Eurozone now. So you're kind of trapped in this uneasy halfway house where the European Union is less than the sum of its parts, but capable of doing more than any individual member state is capable of doing by itself. So less than it could be, but more than we would be individually, if you like. Now, there are two problems here, it seems to me. The first is an easy one. The first is a sort of conceptual problem of European Union that just nags away at you. I don't know. When you've had young kids, right, and they go to bed and they leave a half-finished jigsaw on the floor, and I'm a bit OCD, so I'd look at this jigsaw and I'd have two choices. I'd either finish it just so it looked neat, or I'd put it away. And that's kind of what I feel about the European Union. It's, for God's sake, either disband the thing or turn it into a proper country. But this kind of messing about with a sort of halfway house is so deeply unsatisfactory. And that's one of the problems the EU has, is because there's nothing else like it, we want to put it into a conceptual box that we're happy with. Turn into a state or be an IO. Don't be a bit of each. And I think on a philosophical level, everyone struggles with the European Union. But practically, this translates into the fact that people talk about the European Union as if it should have the solutions to all our problems. Deal with the migration problem. Deal with the Eurozone problem. Why isn't there growth in Europe? It must be down to the European Union. But it doesn't have the tools to deliver on any of these things, because nation states have the last word. And here the danger is that you get this rise of populist politics. Anti-EU, because national politicians are too quick to blame Brussels for their own failings, but too slow to give Brussels the tools it needs to address the real challenges that we all face in Europe today. You have multi-level politics in the United States. You know, after a crisis in part of the United States, that the blame game starts. That the city government blames the state government blames the national government blames both of the other two, and they have at it. You get that in Europe, but the European Union is uniquely ill-adapted to play that game. We have no European media. No one listens to what EU leaders say. People listen to what national politicians say. The EU always gets the blame. And this it should be no surprise that this saps faith in the project. This leads to more Euroscepticism. More and more anti-EU parties get elected to the European Parliament at every passing EU election. It's a kind of death by a thousand cuts. So, ultimately, the European Union will probably muddle through as morale sags. It will be helped by economic growth, which is cyclical rather than due to any particular policies. But the crisis will come back, and in 5, 6, 7, 8 years' time, you'll have someone else standing here saying, the problem with the European Union is it's structurally flawed, and there seems to be no easy way around it. Thank you.